Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
On News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading, rating and all that stuff. Coming up on this week's programme, we're going to be speaking to Lorena Natchi, a researcher in Trinity College Dublin, who set up a lab trying to understand how our brain works and particularly how it works when we're unconscious. She plays clips of Liam Neeson to people while they're in comas. And we're going to find all about that, in a few minutes' time. First, though, it's time to look back at the week's science news. If you have any comments on anything in the programme, by the way, you can email us, science@newstalk.com, or you can tweet us, we're at newstalkscience. Joining me in studio is Dr. Susan Kelleher from DCU's School of Chemical Sciences and Dr. Shane Bergen of UCD. You're both very welcome. Our first story.
And now, another malodorous episode of Higgs in Space!
Is about a biorepository for life on Earth to be stuck out in space somewhere. What's this about?
Well, I'd rather fund more Muppet programs, but speaking of pigs in space, but this is a story from the Journal of Biosciences. And what the scientists did in the journal was they sort of worked out what would be needed to build a biorepository on the moon. Right. And this is something that they say would be beyond the reach of climate breakdown, and it would be the ultimate backup for all living material on Earth. Right. So when I read it first, I was like, this is a really bad idea, because just like geoengineering, it sort of focuses on the wrong thing. Right. And allows for people to say, oh, sure, we'll be fine. You know, we'll just keep plowing ahead with the the emissions, etc.
No, that's a ridiculous thing to say. Go on. Tell me the story.
But I was glad to say that the scientists are very, very realistic here. And they said this is a real plan B, and that we need to start thinking about how we might do this now, so that if we really need to do it in 50 to 100 years' time, we'll be able to do it. They're saying that the biology is sorted, right? That everything else is a matter of engineering. So basically what they would do is they would take seeds, and they would take other ways of bringing DNA up to the moon. And they would
seeds and sperm.
Yes, and they would put it in a big crater in the moon, because it's very cold there. They put it in a crater because the sun's rays would never reach it, and it would be temperature-wise below 196 degrees Celsius, which Susan will know is liquid nitrogen's boiling point. And that's typically the point at which, you know, you can keep things cold, but you can keep them alive. And keeping them alive is crucial. You must have live cells if you want to replicate and clone, so you can create the life again, so you can bring things back. This is why Jurassic Park would never have worked.
Yeah.
You can't clone a dinosaur from fragments of dead DNA. You would have needed that DNA to be alive.
Watch me.
You are our
is that a threat? Okay, so seeds, fine. Although some seeds are quite big.
It's true.
If we're going to do this, like, is it an ark? Are they planning to put two of every animal, so to speak, sperm and egg of every animal?
Yeah, the best model for it is in Svalbard at the moment. So people should Google it, with the seed repository in Svalbard. It looks like something from Lord of the Rings. It's in Svalbard because it's a Norwegian island that's very cold. It was thought to be the perfect freezer, but recently it flooded because of climate effects. And so they were really worried about the potential loss there. Mm. There was also a seed bank in Ukraine because of the fact that they grow so much wheat, and it was destroyed during the war in 2022. So there's a lot of worry about what would happen if we started to lose the DNA needed, particularly for things that we eat.
Those were just seeds though, right? If we're talking about animal, you know, that's quite a lot of, it's a huge amount of work. But yep. they're proposing that animal samples as well as a plant. I think it's a good idea.
It is.
I don't think anyone's going to go, well, we don't need to worry about the
you would be surprised at the amount of people that just think there's going to be a silver bullet for climate change. Like,
there better be.
There isn't, because even if we were to stop emissions today, there are things, particularly sea level rise, that are baked in, that are going to happen. And
true.
It's just a matter of time.
But you do think it's a... No, I was like, shush. I think this is a really good idea, and I would love to see it happen, actually. It'd be quite an exciting project.
It'd be a good documentary to make as well. Maybe you could go with them.
Stay there. I know what you were thinking. Okay, our second story, Susan, has to do with open access, and this is something that I can see your eyes widening. This is it's frustrating to hear about. I'm sure for scientists and researchers, it's mind bogglingly frustrating.
Yes.
Tell me the story.
So it's published in Science, ironically, and I had access to it, which was great. But for those listening who don't know how scientific publishing works, basically, as scientists, we get to do research in the lab and we come up with great discoveries, and then we want to share them with the world. And we've only made those discoveries because we've learned from other people's discoveries.
And you've been publicly funded for the most part.
Absolutely. And basically what happens is that you publish your findings and your ideas in kind of scientific magazines, and they're called journals. And they're all specific kind of scientific magazines based on the area of science that you're in generally. But in order to do that, the scientific journals request what's called an article processing charge, or a fee, for you to do that, which sounds a bit unusual, but this came about from the concept of open access, that anyone who wants to can read that. So instead of paying to read the article, which is where they usually these publishing houses used to make their money, they now say, well, actually, you can publish it for in an open access format, but you now have to charge you to do that. So the issue here is the fees, the amount of them, how big they are, and how there's huge discrepancies around different countries and different organizations and research institutes that can afford these. So, for example, with one of the biggest publishing houses, which is called, you know, basically Nature and Springer, to publish in one of their gold open access, which is everyone can read it, is around $12,000 a paper. So the big issue here is that that I have with this, and I think Shane will jump in with a similar mindset, is that concept of the work being done by publicly funded bodies and then have to put out money to publish those findings. And if you don't, then your work will maybe not open access and won't get cited and won't be seen as much across the scientific community. And that can be massively problematic.
Yeah.
And of course, it's done for profit. So for those of you who don't know, there's a Dutch company called Elsevier, and they're one of the big five, and their profit margins last year were greater than Google or Apple or Amazon. They had a profit margin of around 40%. So they're making like billions every year on this. And I think it's a crisis at this stage,
yeah,
the idea of open access. And that unfair discrepancy between who has 12,000 euro of taxpayers' money ready to go to create, to publish this.
This obviously is not new. The scandal, and it is scandalous, that publicly funded research can't just be put online, you know, peer reviewed, and a small fee paid for that, but just put online. This is the document, anyone can read it. If I paid for it, or if it's publicly funded money, it should at least be available to people within that country. But science is global. It should be everybody who could read it. This stranglehold that these publishers have on scientific publishing has been a scandal for a long time. It seems to me that this is something that's required at EU level.
Mm.
Does the paper mention anything about EU action?
It is published in a paper. It's published in American, but it's also published, I guess they have their own interests at heart, to be a bit cynical about it. They do talk about the profits in the last 5 years have grown from, for the top five publishing houses, grown from about 0.8 billion to 2.5 billion. So while it was always a problem, it's becoming exponentially greater a problem.
We're so stupid. Like, we do all the work, we're publicly paid, all the work is for public goods, and we give that work to be published in for-profit journals. And the only reason we really do that is so that other scientists will read it and policymakers will read it. And ultimately, the marker of the quality of our work is sort of linked to the standard of the journal.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, we do this to get promoted. There is no other real reason to do it. And it's absolutely a pyramid scheme. It is crazy.
It is an absolute Ponzi scheme. Mm. I suppose what also is frustrating about it is that there are a lot of people out there who have hobby interests in a lot of the sciences, mm-hmm, who, if they had access to a lot of these scientific journals as they came out, could genuinely contribute or learn or teach themselves about the world. And that's the purpose of education. The purpose of publishing is for we all to learn about.
I would be a huge supporter of open access. It's just the way that we can do it. There is this Coalition S, which is European-based. Universities have come together, and Ireland's part of it. We say, look, there's a certain amount of these open accesses that we'll pay for every year, but they do run out. So, you know, if you publish early in the year, it's great, but then the money might run out towards the end of the year. So it's not ideal. It is one solution. But there are, you know, I hope the paper goes into a few suggestions and solutions of things where maybe it could be remedied, but it's a big beast to take on, I think.
Yeah. No, it is. It requires something at the level of EU, I would imagine. And I'm surprised it's not something that has really reared its head in a way that I've been aware of anyway.
Mm.
Our third story, Shane, has to do with cats. You love dogs. So I'm surprised you picked this story.
Yeah. As you well know, I'm a dog person. I do like cats. It's just I don't get cats. And cats appear to grieve for fellow pets when they've died. This is work that was done by Applied Animal Behavioral Sciences from Oakland University in the US. And what they did was they surveyed owners of 450 cats who had another pet, either cat or dog, that had died recently. Mm-hmm. And they asked the owners about the cat's behavior after their furry friend had died. And they found that some cats struggled to sleep, went off their food, made yowling noises, and even stopped playing games. Now, mourning is not unusual in the animal kingdom, but it's normally associated with animals that are quite social, like dogs, chimps, elephants. And researchers in this paper are suggesting that we have just got cats wrong, and that in the wild they're far more social than we think, and that maybe they are social, and that's kind of manifesting itself by their mourning. However,
I was going to ask, is that not just a cat being a cat? But you're telling me we've got cats wrong.
Well, I don't know, because this is a classic example of, I think, bad measurement, right? Because ultimately they ask the owners to describe their cat's feelings. Remember, the owner also lost.
They should have asked the dog.
Yeah, they should have asked the dog or the other cat. Yeah. So what was happening was is that the owners were, of course, like in mourning too. And they found that the degree to which the owner described the cat mourning was exactly correlated with the degree to which the owner was
mourning.
Oh my God.
So
in other words, if you're big into your animals and you're really sad because your cat's died, you are more likely to project onto your own cat's behavior. So cats still on the fence.
That is terrible. That just sounds like terrible science.
It's been reported so much lately.
I know, but it sounds really, really bad. That's not great. Okay, our final story, Susan, has to do with nightmares and lonely people.
So recent reports indicate that as much as 33% of the world's population are lonely, and it's seen as a serious public health issue.
Oh.
I know, at the same time, between 10 to 30% of adults, maybe not the same people, it has to be said, struggle with insomnia, and that they're both connected to increased risk of heart disease, stroke and premature death. So this
Which is exactly what you want to hear when you can't sleep, right?
Or when you're lonely and on your own. Yeah.
Better get to sleep.
Sorry. So... they did in this study, so I'll tell you about the study in a minute, but they did at the start of the study talk about the prevalence of nightmares. So then I wondered if you knew how many nightmares in a 3-week period on average people that they surveyed had. And this is a nightmare that's so vivid and terrifying that you wake up and you can't get back to sleep for a while.
Is this,
so
one?
Three
is this during term or outside of term?
They're not students, actually. These are adults in Hong Kong,
one?
America. 3.66.
Wow. One a week?
One a week on average.
God.
So that is, it's so big. And it's actually, there's more women than men.
I can't remember the last
men.
Time I've had one of those.
More women than men. Okay. So maybe maybe ask your wife how she's been sleeping. But then also that the nightmare frequency drops off after the age of 39, which is great news for me. Because I have a big birthday coming up in a few weeks' time.
Right.
And I expect I'll sleep a lot better afterwards. But this study... it's just published in the Journal of Psychology, reported that lonely people tended to have more nightmares and that the researchers looked at the factors associated with the links between the loneliness and both the nightmare frequency and the intensity. So it's a bit like what Shane just spoke about, where they surveyed people. So I'm always a bit, qualitative analysis is very challenging to look at. But they surveyed 827 American adults between the ages of 18 and 81 and asked them about their loneliness scale, their loneliness on a scale of 1 to 7. And then they were asked about their sleeping and whether or not they had nightmares on a scale of 1 to 5 and their stress levels on a scale of 1 to 7. Asking them questions, as you can imagine, to give them an indication of exactly where they were on those scales. And the results not unexpectedly showed that women had greater number of nightmares than the men. And then they showed a strong correlation between people who felt stress and they ruminate, so where you're worrying and you're anxious, or hyperarousal, where you're extra alert or you're super focused, and the number of nightmares that they had. So it's not a surprise to me.
I think they can't offer them anything.
They offer anything. And they say, like, what can we... They themselves in the paper say, well, you know, how can we offer a solution? What kind of solution can we offer? Because it's very complicated, right? It's very complex. But I guess the question is around, you know, loneliness to me is if that's a core problem. We know that there's other big issues around loneliness in society. So that could be something, you know, around if you're not sleeping well, go have a chat with someone, maybe to get that stuff off your mind or whatever. I mean, it's a bit of an unusual
You haven't got an answer for people. That's okay. Yeah. That's not our job.
And,
our job
is to report the science. Thing is like, how lonely are you? You know, the scales are obviously well balanced in that. But I did think for a minute, were they going to give people nightmares and then see, you know, pick a load of lonely people and then give them nightmares? But that didn't. That would have been a really good study.
Good job.
It would have been a great study. I mean, I'm not sure we'd get past the ethics board with any serious momentum. Dr. Susan Keller from DCU School of Chemical Sciences and Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD, thank you very much. Now, we tend to think of consciousness as something that is a state of mind that we have when we're awake and then when we're asleep or we're unconscious. But actually, there's lots of different types of consciousness and there's lots of different mental states that are sometimes in between or even less conscious than we are when we're asleep. How do we understand these states of mind and what can studying them tell us about the hard problem of consciousness itself? Well, Lorena Ratnacci is an associate professor and leader of the Consciousness and Cognition Group at Trinity College Dublin. She joins me now. Lorena, it's great to have you back on the programme. I think your research is really fascinating. And of course, anything to do with consciousness is always something that people are interested in. Can you tell me a little bit about why you are interested in this area of research?
So thanks for having me on the show, first of all. It's a pleasure to be here. And my group studies consciousness and cognition and how it's realized by the human brain. And to me, it's the most exciting area of research. That's why I studied. And it's an area where I think also currently some of the biggest developments are happening. It's an area that, you know, combines so many different aspects of inquiry, including psychology, philosophy, cognitive science, more recently artificial intelligence, and bringing different perspectives. So fundamentally is what we think defines us as human beings, defines our sort of innermost and dearest held types of experiences. And in fact, consciousness in a nutshell is defined as the ability to have an experience, and that can be unpacked in different ways, but that is kind of what we hold as most precious about human life, that ability to experience, to reflect, to have emotion, and to connect with others in that deep level. So it's extremely fascinating, and it's been debated for centuries in terms of what it is. Is it realized by the brain, or does it kind of live outside of the brain? And there's various forms of discussions going on around consciousness. In the last 20 years, we've had sort of an unparalleled ability to make progress in this area because with the advent of neuroimaging scanners, magnetic resonance imaging scanners that enable us to sort of peer into the human mind by analyzing brain activity and linking that to thought processes.
But obviously consciousness is a hard thing to grapple onto, right? And that definition of being able to have an experience, it is so vague in a way, and we don't really know what we're looking for in a way when we talk about consciousness. It means that researchers have to sort of find a very small area of this puzzle and focus on that. And that's part of what you have done in your research. Can you tell me a little bit about what part of consciousness are you trying to understand and how you go about doing that?
Yes, absolutely. That's exactly right. So one way that we can compartmentalize and operationalize consciousness is higher order cognition. So our ability to have memories, to think, to have sustained attention, executive function. So a number of higher order cognition that is necessary for consciousness. And I come from the area of psychology and cognitive neuroscience. And so my training is really in measuring cognition, how we think, what attention looks like. And so through my work, I have been able to develop experimental protocols that we can put somebody in the scanner, we give them a set of instructions, and we can measure specifically to what extent they pay attention in a sustained way to a number of stimuli that are well controlled, and we expect a predicted response to them. So without going into the details, there might be, you know, 50 years of research into the behavioral science of attention. Mm. And now I'm able to take that and build programs that enable us to image how the brain responds to attention, and therefore gaining a signature of consciousness through this proxy of a consciousness that in this case is attention. And then importantly, I think this has incredible ethical and medical implications, being able to get this brain-based signatures of consciousness.
So what you're trying to do, I suppose, is filter out the noise as much as possible by gaining a lot of data from functional MRI, which is kind of like peering into the brain as it's thinking and giving someone a task and really identifying, okay, what's going on in the brain when they have this specific task to do, and then sort of labeling that as you go along.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we know, for example, from other experiments outside of the scanner, that if you are paying attention in a rigorous way, your behavior should look like this, and then we can link that with what the brain is doing when the person is inside the scanner.
And by doing something like that, would you be able to spot different modes of attention? Because there's something called creative flow, where someone feels like they're able to give their full solid attention to someone. There's some people who have attentive disorder. When we look at the brain as it tries to pay attention to a task, if we're looking at, whereabouts, by the way, are you looking at in the brain? Is it networks across the brain?
Yes, there are networks across. So the frontoparietal brain network is a very currently well-studied and characterized network that supports sustained attention and executive function more broadly. And we can characterize through the behavior of this frontoparietal network the extent to which individuals are paying attention. And the way I look at it is by characterizing typical sustained attention. Then if somebody is, for example, has been in an accident and loses the behavioral signs of consciousness, then and their conscious status is at question, then we can use this signatures of attention to understand whether a person is conscious or not.
Okay, so this is where it's really, really interesting. So talk to me about your research with patients who are under anesthesia. What is the methodology? What are you doing exactly?
So what's interesting about having the signatures of consciousness is that normally when you and I are talking, we don't need to question whether we are conscious.
So yeah,
as Alan Turing famously said, we extend a polite convention to each other that we are conscious. But what happens when a person cannot speak or behave in any way? They seem to be shut off from the environment. This is where we don't know whether someone is conscious. So in some cases, we want to know whether somebody is conscious or not. And in other cases, like in the case of anesthesia, we want to make sure that somebody is not conscious. So we want to actually make sure that consciousness is abolished. And so this is why it's important in this case to have this measure of a brain-based measure of whether somebody is conscious or not. So in anesthesia, in surgical anesthesia, what happens is that a proportion of individuals experience accidental awareness under surgical anesthesia. In fact, it's everybody's nightmare before going into an operation that they might wake up and actually feel and feel pain and experience what's going on. And that motivates the work that I have done in anesthesia. And so one of the intriguing aspects of anesthesia is that even though it's been administered to reversibly abolish consciousness in the medical context for over 150 years, we don't really know precisely how it works. And this leads to the fact that currently we don't have very sensitive depth of anesthesia measures. And so what we know is that different people respond very differently to anesthesia. Even the most widely used anesthetic agent, propofol, you and I might have a very different response to it. And there are algorithms that are used clinically that will titrate the dose based on demographics like sex and age and body weight to try and get it right. And even so, some people will not get deeply anesthetized and will have this accidental awareness. So that is what motivates the work that I do. And in a study that we published last year, we asked specifically whether there are brain structures that can actually explain why you and I respond differently to anesthesia that we can then use to measure before we go into anesthesia whether we have a predisposition to accidental awareness.
Right. Can you see in the brain any pattern or any activity or lack of activity that allows you to say this person is conscious and this person isn't? Because it sounds like that is a binary thing, but it isn't, is it?
It's not. So there is a degree, And this is, we use this, we leverage this knowledge in this recent study that we published that was actually made quite an impact in the field. What we did there is we put individuals that were healthy in the scanner while they were deeply anesthetized at different stages. And in this case, we had a medical anesthesiologist delivering the anesthesia, and we chose to measure how people responded in the level of what's called moderate sedation. So people are drowsy and they become slowed down, but they're still responsive. So they'll give us a response, which is important for then trying to figure out to what extent they are processing the environment. And what we found is that we asked people to do a very, very simple task, which is as soon as they heard a beep, to press a button. And that's called a reaction time task. And what we found is that even though everybody received the appropriate dosage of anesthetic propofol and was behaviorally assessed to be in the moderate sedation stage by three different anesthesiologists, 30% of our participants actually were not slowed down at all. They were as if they didn't receive propofol.
So they performed as well in the test as if they were conscious, but the anesthesiologist would have said, they're pretty sedated right now. They should be very slow.
That's right. So it's very, very strange. So what happens when people get anesthetized is that they different parts of our mind's functions break apart in unpredictable ways. So people might be slowed down and might behaviorally respond as if they are drunk, the behavioral signs of moderate sedation. But when they are pressing a button, they're very, very fast.
Yeah.
So that part of their reaction is still processing the environment in a speedy way.
Does that mean that the anesthesia is working on parts of their brain more than others?
That's right, and that
is variable from person to person.
That's right.
And if you were to do an MRI or a functional MRI while this was happening, would you be able to see the brain waves or the electrical activity changing as they lost consciousness and got more and more sedation?
Yeah. So it shows that the behavioral measures that we use ostensibly in the clinic to measure consciousness are faulty.
Hmm.
So what we saw, so we do need more sensitive measures. What we saw in people who are sedated by clinical definitions, but were very, very fast, we found that their brains, they had their particular brain structure, so in particular in the frontal parietal cortex that I mentioned, this group had a higher gray matter volume than the group of individuals that became predictably slower under anesthesia. They were more resistant in that sort of, they had more brain cells, and literally more gray matter volume means more brain cells in this part of the brain, and also stronger functional connectivity, which is another measure. It's a functional measure. And importantly, we could see this from their brains before they got sedated.
Okay, so you would be able to predict then, if you did a brain scan of someone, you'd be able to predict this person has a lot of gray matter. They're much less likely to be knocked out by the standard dose. We need to give them a bit more of a dose.
Exactly.
Okay, I mean, it might be a sledgehammer to crack a nut sort of a situation. What is the risk of just giving people more sedation? Why don't we just give people the maximum allowable dose?
Well, it's tricky. I mean, I'm not an anesthesiologist, but I know that anesthesia is a bit of an art, and they do have to really orchestrate the maintenance of basic life-sustaining functions like breathing, like heart rate, and blood circulation, all of that, while also really suppressing as much as possible arousal and brain function maintain those life-sustaining functions. So we don't want to knock people out of to the level where they're, you know, going to perish to their detriment. And that's why it's a difficult art, and that's why it's titrated by certain demographic variables.
Right. So essentially what you're doing is almost sort of putting out these candles of consciousness, and you can't just, you know, blow them all out at once, because someone would literally, they'd cease to function. Their brain would cease to function. They would die.
Yes.
Okay. So what about people then who have locked-in syndrome? What happens to them, and what is their brain function showing? Does someone who is unconscious because of anesthesia have an identical brain pattern and response to someone who is in a coma and non-responsive? Are those two states of being in a coma because of anesthesia and being in a coma and locked in, are those two identical brain states?
So there are some parallels between the two, and that's why it's so interesting to study, the brain science of consciousness. So when we talk about disordered consciousness, we talk about an umbrella of conditions that individuals may experience after severe brain injury, maybe after a car accident or various form of traumatic brain injury, where they will lose all behavioral responsivity. They will lose the ability to speak or fixate or track with their eyes and so on, and they become entirely shut off from the environment. And at the bedside, they do not respond to repeated commands by the medical staff, various forms of stimulation, and they appear to be unconscious based on the clinical definition.
They can't even blink.
They can't blink. Yeah. They have, in some cases, there's different levels. So the vegetative state is defined by sleep-wake cycle, so they will have some arousal, coma. In the case of coma, the people don't even appear to be awake and asleep, so there's different states. Hmm. But interestingly, what we have discovered is that up to 1 in 5 of individuals that are clinically diagnosed to be in the vegetative state actually have brain signatures of consciousness when measured with rigorous protocols that are testing for the presence of consciousness.
Is that figure still the best one we're working off? Because I remember reading that a number of years ago and being shocked that 1 in 5 patients that is non-responsive may be locked in and aware.
Yes,
we still think
yes.
That figure is accurate?
Absolutely. It is accurate.
Wow.
And there is some really stellar research groups that are working on taking this forward and improving, it's really, in some cases, life or death decisions that depend on whether consciousness is present or not. I'll just make one small correction, which is when we talk about locked in is slightly different because the locked in state is defined by a minimal presence of behavioral responsivity. So people who are locked in are able to have vertical eye movements that indicates that they are conscious.
Oh, right, okay.
So with their eyes, they will respond yes or no. Sometimes this is missed, but with rigorous behavior protocols in specialized centers, they will be found. Whereas the patients in the vegetative state, they are, by all internationally agreed criteria, non-responsive. But yet 1/5 of these individuals are actually consciously aware. They just cannot express it.
That is a really important distinction. And this is a subject that I'm very interested in from just a scientific point of view, but also from a moral point of view. This is something I want to follow up with you again, Lorena, if that's okay. You also, in your testing of patients under anaesthetic, have been playing them clips of Liam Neeson in the movie Taken. What is that about?
So that came, that was a progression with different forms of tests that I developed. But I landed on that particular form of testing. I started by testing individuals, whether they could say yes or no in response to a question or in order to enable brain-based communication, brain-computer interface with people who, as we discussed, are completely shut off, but they are able to still modulate their brain activity to show that they are conscious. But the problem with that is that really, when somebody has been in a severe, for example, automobile accident or has a severe brain injury, they're not, able to perform very complex tasks. So, we might ask them to pay attention according to very specific experimental conditions that to a patient who is severely brain injured are arbitrary and are effortful. So I came to this as a solution of how can we engage individuals who are brain injured in a way that really draws out their ability to pay attention, their understanding through engaging them, through kind of grabbing their attention, almost in a way that they cannot stop but pay attention. So first I developed a test that involved looking at a short clip by Alfred Hitchcock. And that's very suspenseful, and I characterized it very well. And I showed that actually some patients could follow the movie on a moment-to-moment basis and feel suspense and emotion in the same way as healthy individuals, despite being unconscious or diagnosed as unconscious for 16 years, which is was an incredible study. And we moved on from that because individuals under surgical anesthesia, under deep anesthesia, have their eyes closed. That's one of the first functions to go when we become anesthetized, is that we close our eyes. So I wanted the same capability, being able to draw somebody's attention in a naturalistic way without giving them some crazy experimental instructions. So I went for a short narrative. I tested different ones, and I landed on a very suspenseful 5 minute narrative from the movie Taken, where it basically... it's a moment that the daughter gets kidnapped and the father is talking to the kidnappers and says, "I'll get you." And it's in 5 minutes you have a narrative arc and it's very suspenseful. And that really draws us and an individual who's brain injured in a very natural way. And I'm able to measure that in their brain activity.
"I don't know who you are. I don't know what you want. If you are looking for a ransom, I can tell you I don't have money. But what I do have are a very particular set of skills. Skills I have acquired over a very long career. Skills that make me a nightmare for people like you. If you let my daughter go now, that'll be the end of it. I will not look for you. I will not pursue you. But if you don't, I will look for you. I will find you. And I will kill you."
So... usually when you're doing brain experiments, they're kind of complicated. Listen to this, pay attention to that. It's not very interesting or stimulating. We've actually talked about this on the program before. In your case, you're playing something that's really engaging, something they're likely to listen to, and then gauging their ability to follow that.
Yes,
and you're finding that
absolutely.
Even if you have a brain injury, you're able to sometimes follow quite a complex
narrative.
It kind
of maximizes their ability to get engaged. It's an arresting stimulus that you can't but pay attention if you are consciously aware.
Really cool. For now, it's been great having you in the studio and hearing about your research. That's Lorena Nachi, Associate Professor and Leader of the Consciousness and Cognition Project at Trinity College Dublin. Thanks, Lorena.
Thank you.
That's mad. It's such a cultural reference, isn't it? Aidan McKelvey, producer of the programme, joins me in studio to go through some of your comments from last week. Taken as a movie. The Liam Neeson film. I haven't seen it, I don't think.
You've never seen it?
No, but I've seen so many memes from it. I've got to watch it.
Yeah, well, I mean...
is it good or is it just really cartoony?
No, it's fun. Like, it's like a... it's not like an Arnie movie. It doesn't have Arnie. But you know the way you're kind of going... you're watching a good Arnie movie and you're like, this is kind of nonsense, but by God, I'm enjoying it.
Yeah.
And it's got
I like that.
Yeah.
Unlike the new Wolverine Deadpool film, which is the biggest load of...
superhero movies, like, give it up, lads.
Yeah, no, it's really...
it's done, it's over. It was like, it was over at the turn of Christopher Nolan Batman, it was over.
Have you watched the Spider-Man, the animated
into
ones?
Into
the Spider-Verse.
Spider-Verse, that's it. I watched it only recently, actually.
Oh, it's so good. I mean, that is just amazing storytelling. Anyway, sorry, off track. Anyway, the Liam Neeson thing, it's kind of mad, isn't it? But it's a good way, because we were talking to... can't remember the name of the what was his name? John John Cracker. He was talking about how, you know, standard rehabilitation protocols in hospitals are in this horrible, you know, plastic gray and green environment. And they are boring and repetitive. And he was like, let's make rehab fun. And he like made these video games that forced you to move in a certain way that was really good for your rehabilitation. What Lorena Nachi's doing is she, instead of getting people to remember a complex set of instructions like, you know, touch this or remember this or a list of words, she's saying, okay, listen to this clip from, you know, Taken with Liam Neeson. Could you follow that? You know, and like you do need to be able to understand the context of that in a conscious, well, higher consciousness way. And that's a good way of testing that as opposed to getting people to do stupid and boring repetitive tasks. So I think engagement is becoming really important in understanding consciousness and also engagement of people to do tasks that otherwise are quite boring.
Yeah, you'd imagine we have great scope to bring it into education. I haven't been in school in years, so I don't know how much they do it. But if you think about the amount of students who, and this program is an example for me, like I did science in school and I enjoyed it, but some of it was really tough. But you could engage someone with a film or a documentary a lot more than, you know, learn these 10 points about Stalin's reign in USSR.
Pedagogy, my youth, was just really, really poor. And they just, it seemed like someone didn't really care to think about it for 5 minutes, you know. Do we care about that these kids remember this stuff? Yes. Do we think that there may be a better way of giving this information rather than just saying it at them? You know, it's crazy.
Yeah.
All right. Some comments from last week. If you remember, if you're listening to last week's episode, we offered a researcher credit to anyone who would listen back to one of the episodes because we were too lazy to do it and verify whether or not we sweat neutrinos, which seemed to both you and I at the time as someone mishearing the
episode. Totally discredited our brief.
Yeah, we were like, yeah, someone suggested. I was like, nah, that doesn't
listen, I heard
that
it,
sounds wrong. Turns out we do indeed sweat neutrinos. So we have some people who are going to mention in the program. Someone has just said, do I get a researcher credit, but they haven't given their name. So there's a few of those. So they will not be mentioned, unfortunately. David said, in the neutrino episode at 3:41, I heard we make them in accelerators as well, which could have been misheard as in our sweat as well. But that's not it, because someone else says, right after that, your body emits neutrinos, the salt in your body decays, and you emit quite a substantial flux. So likely that the listener took that to be sweat emits neutrinos, which is essentially true. So thank you very much for that, David. You're going to get a researcher credit. And then Fiona Kane says, I'm probably the 746th person to let you know that in 3:35 in the extra podcast on neutrinos, Professor Halzen says your body emits neutrinos because the salt in your body decays. I especially liked him saying you emit a quite substantial flux. So thank you very much, Fiona Kane and David. You will get a researcher credit as well as a Garoda Sullivan, who is a regular listener to the program. He says, just listen to the ep. Yes, you were talking about neutrinos and sweat. You were talking about the ICE Neutrino Observatory, and he says substantial flux. So thanks very much for that.
I'm going to use that phrase from now on. If one of my mates is, you know, a bit smelly, just, you're emitting a substantial flux.
Quite a substantial flux. Very good. So that's it. Amazing that so many people did actually bother to do. We should get them to do more. I think we should get people to do more stuff.
We could use this power.
Yeah, exactly.
For nefarious.
What about asking people, because Lorena Natchi was talking about, you know, people who wake up during anaesthesia. I would love to hear stories of people who actually have woken up during anaesthesia.
Absolutely.
That's a real, like, that's got harks back to my days doing talk show radio. Have you ever woken up during anaesthesia? We want to hear from you. You can WhatsApp us. We want you to email us, science@newstalk.com, or you can tweet us. We're at @newstalkscience. And we'll give you a contributor credit next week's episode. This is how we get him. That's how we get him in.
Because
we've never
like
had so many responses to a confetti. Stupid request that actually asked you to do so. Right. So that's it on this week's program. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey producing, researchers Fiona Kane, David O'Donovan, and Garoud O'Sullivan, and Hugo da Silva on sound. We'll be back with more in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.